Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, May 30th, 2019, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is a Courthouse Steps decision discussion on Home Depot USA Incorporated v. Jackson. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Mr. Ted Frank, who is Director of Litigation at the Hamilton Lincoln Law Institute. After our speaker gives his remarks today, we will move to an audience Q&A, so please keep in mind what questions you have for this case or for our speaker in particular. Thank you very much for sharing with us today. Ted, the floor is yours for your remarks.
Thank you. Thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this. The General Removal Statute, 28 U.S.C. 1441A, provides that any civil action over which a federal court would have original jurisdiction may be removed to federal court by the defendant or the defendants if all of them agree. This was modified by the Class Action Fairness Act of 2005, which provides that in addition to this, a class action, as defined by the statute, may be removed to federal court by any defendant without the consent of all defendants. And that's 28 U.S.C. 1453B. The question that Home Depot versus Jackson raises is whether either provision allows a third-party counterclaim defendant, that is, a party brought into a lawsuit through a counterclaim filed by the original defendant, to remove the counterclaim filed against it. And as background, there was decades ago called Shamrock Oil and Gas Corporation versus Sheets that held that a counterclaim defendant, that is the original plaintiff who is then sued by the original defendant in a counterclaim, does not have the right to remove under 1441. After all, the counterclaim defendant, who's the original plaintiff, chose to be in state court in the first place, and therefore, given the general limits and narrow constructions of federal jurisdiction, given those limits, the removal statute did not extend to such counterclaim defendants. The Class Action Fairness Act was passed in 2005 because of a general sense that plaintiffs' attorneys were using state courts to evade federal jurisdiction, especially in the problem of class actions, and you had problems of state courts in very plaintiff-friendly jurisdictions exercising nationwide jurisdiction on matters of national importance and often in ways that were very favorable to plaintiffs' attorneys based in that jurisdiction. So Madison County, Illinois, Texarkana, Arkansas, those sorts of places were hosting very abusive class actions that were viewed by Congress as abuses of the system. And they expanded federal jurisdiction to account for that. And the Supreme Court has elsewhere held that the traditional limits on federal jurisdiction do not apply in the context of the Class Action Fairness Act because of Congress's intent to expand federal jurisdiction to address the problems identified in the Class Action Fairness Act. So this particular case came about in 2016. Citibank filed a debt collection action in state court against George Jackson for money that he owed on a Home Depot credit card. Jackson turned around and filed a counterclaim for a putative class action against Citibank, against Home Depot, and against another defendant, Carolina Water Systems, alleging a massive conspiracy to induce homeowners to buy expensive water treatment systems that they couldn't actually afford. And Jackson claimed that this was consumer fraud under North Carolina law. Home Depot, who had nothing to do with the original lawsuit, says, I don't want to be in North Carolina state court defending a class action, so I'm going to use the Class Action Fairness Act and remove this to federal court. But Jackson moved to remand, arguing that a third-party additional counter-defendant like Home Depot does not get to remove cases under either 1441 or 1453. The district court and the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit agreed with Jackson and Home Depot petitioned to the Supreme Court. This is a decades-old question when it applies to 1441, and I guess a question as old as the Class Action Fairness Act when it applies to the Class Action Fairness Act. So the Supreme Court was interested in the case and took it. And the opinion itself had an interesting lineup. Justice Thomas wrote for a 5-4 majority, but it's not your typical 5-4 majority that Justice Thomas writes for, in that he joined with Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, and held that removal was not available to a third-party defendant who not purposefully availed itself of federal court. Thomas's reasoning was as follows. Section 1441 can only apply to original defendants. The Federal Rules of Civil Procedure distinguish between defendants and counter-defendants and third-party defendants. And since the statute says defendants, that must be what it means. After all, in other removal statutes, Congress has used broader language, and so it must have, by inference, must have meant the narrower term when it applied, when it used the word defendants in 1441. And in addition, the other language in 1441 that Thomas was persuaded by was that to remove a case under 1441, you need the consent of all of the defendants. And if third-party defendants are defendants under 1441, well, why aren't counterclaim defendants and other sorts of defendants? And then do you need the permission of the original defendant, who's now the counterplaintiff, to remove? And that doesn't make sense. So therefore, 1441 must only apply to just the original set of defendants that were sued. Well, but there's still 1453. And after all, this is exactly the scenario Congress cared about. A defendant who doesn't want to be in state court, getting hailed in for a nationwide class action, or at least in this case, just a North Carolina class action. But it's still, you know, it's the same sort of thing that Alexander Hamilton warned about in Federalist Number 80, the danger of an out-of-state defendant being unfairly treated by state courts. And that's the sort of thing that our federal system was supposed to solve for in permitting diversity jurisdiction. 1453 and then the Class Action Fairness Act in general is a very broad exercise of diversity jurisdiction. So can Home Depot use that to remove to federal court? And Thomas said once again, no, that 1453 only permitted the sort of removal permitted by 1441. And while 1453 states that any defendant can remove, that still is limited to the set of defendants that could remove under 1441, because it's modified by the clause without the consent of all defendants. And therefore, it's just getting rid of those limits that 1441 imposes, but it doesn't go beyond what 1441 permits in terms of who can exercise that in the first place. Justice Alito dissented, along with joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. He raised the arguments that I've sort of alluded to here, that this is not the case of a counterclaim defendant like Shamrock Oil. This is a third-party defendant who was hailed into court and had no interest in being there. And that's exactly what Congress was trying to reach when it passed the Class Action Fairness Act. And therefore, that's the plain meaning of defendants with respect to 1453. As he phrased it, it's plain and unambiguous text that must be enforced according to its terms. A defendant is a person sued in a civil proceeding as opposed to a plaintiff. And it shouldn't just be limited to defendants within the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, especially given that it's modified by any defendant. The fact that Home Depot is a third party defendant is adjectives like third party modify nouns. They pick out a subset of the category that possesses a certain quality, and Home Depot is still a defendant, even though they're a third party defendant. So given that CAFA 1453 says that any defendant can remove, it's unlike the general removal provision that allows removal by the defendant or defendants. CAFA extends to any defendant, and any has an expansive meaning. It means one or some indiscriminately of whatever kind, and that's what should be applied to here. So as Alito says, unless third-party defendants like Home Depot differ in some way that is relevant to removal as a matter of text or precedent or common sense, they fall within CAFA's coverage of defendant. Alito goes into great detail about the history of CAFA and why it was meant to go beyond what 1441 indicated. The lower courts have not indicated otherwise. And there's nothing in CAFA that indicates that Congress was intending to exclude third-party defendants from any defendant. The respondents argue, well, that you have removal statutes like the American Invents Act, which permits any party to remove a lawsuit involving patent or copyright claims. Thus, Jackson argued, if Congress wanted to include more than original defendants, it could have said any party or a party. But Alito distinguishes that because he doesn't believe that CAFA was meant to reach original plaintiffs and or overturn Shamrock Oil. CAFA had to use narrower language than any party, even if it did want to go beyond what 1441 applied to. So the fact that it didn't use the America Invents Act language of any party doesn't indicate that it didn't mean to include third-party defendants. That's where we are now. We now have a substantially narrower Class Action Fairness Act. Plaintiffs have a loophole to keep class actions in state court. And with the current makeup of Congress, it's unlikely that that loophole will be closed anytime soon. That will certainly encourage potential future third-party defendants, at least, to want to use arbitration clauses in their contractual arrangements to avoid the problem of being hailed into state court as they were before the Class Action Fairness Act passed in 2005. If we have time after question, I'm happy to discuss how all of this came about because of the Erie decision, which I think is an unpopular view even within the Federalist Society. But I think it's worthwhile to understand how Erie sort of changed the dynamic of diversity jurisdiction 82 years ago and has had some drastic effects that the Class Action Fairness Act was meant to correct to some extent will now be somewhat limited in doing that. Happy to take your questions.
Well, thank you so much, Ted. We do appreciate your remarks. It does look like we do have two questions in the queue so far. Ted, here comes your first caller.
Hi, this is Bob Fitzpatrick. I have two quick questions. You talk about loophole. I'm an employment lawyer. So tell me, if I were representing plaintiffs, how this creates a loophole that would get employment cases stuck in state court, or just tell me about other loopholes outside of employment law. And then the second thing I'm interested in is, I guess how one would put it, what accounts for losing Justice Thomas, and is the unstated reason, because there's nothing in his opinion about it, but is the unstated reason because Justice Thomas at bottom is a state's rightist and believed strongly in state courts and therefore was motivated to keep these cases in state court despite CAFA?
With respect to the first question, I'm not sure how you can sort of get an employment law case in as a third-party defendant. The typical scenario where this comes in as a third-party defendant is debtor owes a creditor money, creditor sues. These suits are for a few hundred dollars, so they're in a small claims court or state court or an arbitration. And faced with a suit for $300, sometimes it's larger if it's, say, for a mortgage. The debtor countersues the creditor and then brings in lots of other defendants, as happened here, where this was just a dispute between Citibank and Jackson over a debt that Jackson owed on his Home Depot branded credit card. But Jackson turned around and alleged a wide-ranging conspiracy. Just off the top of my head, I don't see a scenario where that would come in an employment class action. Mm-hmm. If the employee would need to be sued and then would need to sue an employer who wasn't in the original suit. And it's hard to imagine what sort of nexus would be there. You could create some sort of weird scenario where an employee is
creditor's rights.
This is a debtor-creditor dispute, so I think that's pretty much the only scenario where a consumer where a typical plaintiff is a defendant to begin with and then brings somebody
right.
in as a third-party
right.
defendant. Maybe you're aware of cases where employees get sued by an employer's client and the employee turns around.
That's a rare day, and you know what when that happens.
So,
what's your take on Justice Thomas, if I can ask?
As you know, Justice Thomas doesn't give many signals at oral argument. So, you know, we'll have to wait for his papers to be released 30 years after we're all dead, I guess. But
mm-hmm.
I think your speculation is as good as any speculation I could come up with. He could just be skeptical of, you know, he just might have been persuaded by the textual analysis that the plaintiffs made or disapproved of the sort of implicit attack on state courts that may have been exhibited in some of the amicus briefs. We know that he's skeptical of preemption, federal preemption, for example. And so the typical civil justice arguments that hold sway with the other four justices on the right side of the aisle carry a lot less weight with Thomas. So
yeah.
On the other hand, on Frank v. Gauss, he was perfectly happy to be very critical of Cypress settlements and the abuse of
right.
plaintiffs' attorneys there. So it's a mystery.
Well, thanks, and thanks for everything that you do.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, caller. We do appreciate your question. Ted, here is your next caller.
Hey, Ted, it's Sam Miarelli. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on how we might start to see creatively pleaded plaintiff's lawyer complaints coming in to try to maybe bring in a third-party defendant that maybe they know has a view on this and might try to blow up the CAFA jurisdiction on their case, which would, you know, potentially give them the opportunity to bring back the bad old days of the abuse of settlements.
You know, it'll be interesting to see whether you start to see, say, sham lawsuits where a sham plaintiff sues a sham defendant, and then the sham defendant brings the real suit, which is a third-party class action against a variety of defendants. You would need a very friendly state court judge to stretch certain things out, but as we know from the state of the world in 2004, such judges exist. These sorts of complaints would only be brought before them in the first place. I think we'll have to wait to see how much this shakes out. I think it's far from clear, but certainly the plaintiff's bar is very entrepreneurial, and they'll come up with creative ways to take advantage of this interpretation of CAFA. We saw earlier attempts to try to create loopholes in CAFA that the Supreme Court was happy to close down on in Standard Fire versus Nowles. We saw the Microsoft case last term where plaintiffs would voluntarily dismiss their case and then appeal that, seeking to get a de facto interlocutory review on the class certification decision. The Supreme Court was happy to shut down those sorts of gamesmanship plays, but not here. It's hard to imagine how they'll ever get this back in front of the Supreme Court again, because certainly third-party defendants can try to remove and then can appeal the denial of the removal. But I think you're going to have to see several years of abuse before you get a five-justice majority on the Supreme Court willing to acknowledge that they made a mistake here. There's, I think, also a sense that when it comes to Supreme Court rulings that make quote-unquote mistakes on statutory interpretation, they're happy to let Congress fix it, even though I think we also know that Congress isn't likely to fix this anytime soon.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, especially seeing the entrepreneurialism with new definitions of what is and isn't a coupon.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, caller. We do appreciate your question. So here is our next caller.
Hi, this is Michael Rossman with the Center for Individual Rights. I have two questions for you, Ted. First, suppose Home Depot, instead of trying to remove, next time they just run into federal court and they file a declaratory judgment against the counterclaim plaintiff and a class of such individuals that he represents and seek a declaratory judgment. Is there any reason? Obviously, the district judge might choose to stay that action in its discretion, but given CAFA and its goals, it might not. So my first question is there anything to prevent the defendant from doing that? And my second question is, to what degree do you think the court was influenced, or Justice Thomas maybe, was influenced by the previous holding of the court that a plaintiff who was then a counterclaim defendant was not a defendant for purposes of removal?
Certainly. Well, it's funny you ask that first question, because that is something a client of mine tried 15 years ago. They were getting...
This was before or after CAFA?
This is before CAFA. They were getting sued in Illinois state court. The Illinois state court wouldn't enforce the arbitration clauses. They couldn't, under the Seventh Circuit's interpretation of diversity jurisdiction, they couldn't remove the class actions or I guess it was a class action. They couldn't remove the suits into federal court because there wasn't diversity jurisdiction, because the initial plaintiff didn't have a $75,000 claim. So they attempted just what you propose, a class action brought against a class of plaintiffs or a class of defendants, excuse me. And I forget the abstention doctrine that was at issue. It was one of the abstention doctrines.
Just a general abstention, you know, if there's another case going on that has the same events. But it's a discretionary doctrine, I think,
It is a discretionary doctrine.
And perhaps CAFA has changed the exercise of that discretion.
And certainly clever defense attorneys are paid to come up with clever ideas like that. And maybe some of them are on this call and are taking notes, and they'll think of a way to distinguish the Seventh Circuit case of Cigna versus Kaiser and why the CAFA changes the abstention doctrines identified in that case. But not having looked at that in 15 years, I'm not really prepared to do more than issue spots rather than...
Well, let me put it, the CAFA would still apply to the proposed lawsuit. In other words, you wouldn't need complete diversity jurisdiction.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's interesting. I don't know off the top of my head whether class action as defined in CAFA applies to class defendants, but it's possible. It's possible that it does if there's $5 million at stake and an interstate class of defendants. Though I don't know if a declaratory judgment creates diversity jurisdiction for the amounts in controversy. That's an interesting question also. That again, there's an answer there, and all I can do on this phone call without preparation is to spot the issue and say there's an answer there, and it'll cut one way or the other. So that's a creative approach, and it might work, and it might not, and there might already be law out there completely precluding it that I don't know off the top of my head that research would turn up one way or the other. You had a second question.
Second question had to do with the degree and extent to which the prior holding, I forgot the name of the case now.
Oh, Shamrock, yes.
In Shamrock, yes,
well,
thank you.
Well, both the majority and dissent refer to it. It cuts both ways. And in law review articles and federal practice and procedure horn books, everybody sort of noted that there was this just outstanding question of 1441 after Shamrock, where, okay, obviously a counter defendant can't remove, but what about a third party defendant? You know, Shamrock Oil had a lengthy discussion of the history and the purposes of removal, and the arguments that apply to a counter defendant don't entirely map onto the arguments that apply to a third party defendant.
Oh, sure.
But given that one is voluntarily in state court and one is involuntarily in state court, Thomas, I think, looking very closely at the text, is happy to say that, well, defendants mean defendants and doesn't mean counter defendants, and therefore it doesn't mean third party defendants. So it's interesting. It's it has some similarities to sort of the Burford case, where you had a much clearer text, and a 6-3 majority, including Roberts and Kennedy, held, well, that's not what Congress meant. And so the only justices being consistent of the seven who voted in the Burford case and in this one are Justice Thomas, who both ways said the text is the text and that's the end of it, even if that's not what Congress meant, and Justice Roberts, who joined the Justice Alito dissent here and said let's read the text in a manner that makes sense of what Congress was trying to do here.
Thank you.
Burwell, not Burford. Sorry. Burford's an abstention doctrine. King versus Burwell is what I meant to say there.
That one I remember.
Yeah. That was Josh Blackman Bate, in case he's still on the call.
Well, caller, thank you so much for your questions. We do appreciate you participating today. Looks like we do have one more question in the queue, Ted. Here is our next caller.
Good afternoon. I just had a quick question, or maybe ask for a comment, that Home Depot certainly has stores in North Carolina and you know, Volkswagen and all those cases. They probably had an expectation, you know, that they could or would be sued in state court. And I'll just let you comment on that.
The CAFA has an exception for local disputes. So Home Depot might not even have been able to get CAFA removal, even under that circumstance. But the fact CAFA creates broader federal jurisdiction in that it doesn't require complete diversity, just partial diversity. You'll note that one of the two third-party defendants was a local North Carolina dealer, which was presumably brought in not because they're hoping to collect millions of dollars from the local dealer, but to defeat complete diversity. So that sort of just leaves the CAFA removal. I didn't look at the Fourth Circuit decision or the district court decision to see if they reached the exception relating to local disputes. After all, every member of the class probably be in North Carolina. But Home Depot is, while they have stores in North Carolina, and there's no question about North Carolina State Court having personal jurisdiction over Home Depot, they're not a citizen of North Carolina and therefore are entitled to, even if they were sued, you know, even if it was just George Jackson bringing a personal injury suit against Home Depot for an injury that he suffered slipping on the floor of a Home Depot. And if he brought it for seeking more than $75,000, Home Depot would, despite the fact that it had stores in North Carolina, would be able to remove under standard diversity jurisdiction. That Home Depot has stores in North Carolina doesn't really go to the issue of whether they're entitled to a federal forum.
Thank you, caller. We do have one more question in the queue. Let's go ahead and go to our next caller.
Hi, Ted. This is Bob Fitzpatrick again. I just wanted to comment back, if I could, real quickly about the gentleman who called in about suing a defendant class. I think there's two things that ought to be considered there. One is, I think the Knorr-Pennington doctrine may shut that down, but he also ought to take a look at one of the new judges on the Fourth Circuit, I'm probably butchering his name, Judge Quattlebaum, wrote an opinion back, I think, in April in a defendant class action case, Bell versus Burkett, where he compares defendant class actions to unicorns. So that's a rarity that we never see. And it's an interesting opinion. You ought to take a look at that. My question, putting aside those comments, my question is, Justice Thomas, in his opinion, in a footnote, says if we're going to buy into Home Depot's argument, then we have to reverse Shamrock. And I gather you say, no, not necessarily so. One can distinguish the holding in Shamrock and still have ruled in Home Depot's favor. Could you articulate that for us?
Shamrock, it was speaking solely of 1441, and it was relying on just a sort of sense that it's the difference between a counter defendant who has voluntarily availed itself of a state court and is deemed equitably, at least, to be stuck with that decision. First of all, I don't know that it's such a bad thing if Shamrock is reversed. That you decide that you're okay with a state court forum for a $300 dispute doesn't mean that you're okay with a state court forum for a $5 million dispute. Would it be such a horrible thing if a plaintiff, having been counterclaimed against, decides that they now want to be in federal court? That doesn't bother me personally, though obviously a court that cares about stare decisis doesn't want to reverse itself willy-nilly. And maybe that's, at the end of the day, what Justice Thomas was concerned about, that he didn't think he could distinguish between, at least textually, the difference between a counter defendant and a third party defendant. And for better or worse, Shamrock Oil was written at a time where they sat and tried to parse the intent of Congress rather than look at the text, and decided that the intent of Congress wasn't to give the removal right to counter defendants. Though, again, Thomas does have, I think, the point that since 1441 speaks of the consent of all the defendants, if defendants includes third-party defendants and counter defendants, that makes no sense. So because it's talking about the removal of civil actions rather than the removal of claims. There's an argument that can go both ways. And I think the Alito dissent focuses on 1453 rather than on 1441. But Alito discusses Shamrock Oil and why it doesn't dictate a reading of 1453, at least, that precludes third-party defendants from removing, even if it isn't meant to overturn Shamrock.
Well, thanks. That's interesting. That's helpful. Appreciate it.
Thank you, caller. We do appreciate your question. We do have another question in the queue. Here is our next audience caller.
Hey, Ted. This is Dan Gibson. I was just curious. It appears to me, as you pointed out, that Justice Thomas's opinion is basically the text is the text, and a great deal of the dissent is devoted to sort of a purposive reading of the text, if you will. But I wonder if they were giving at least a hint or suggestion that even if you read it text as text, the way Thomas does, that there may be a constitutional problem with the distinction that's drawn. And I look at a little bit of the language that says, I cannot imagine why a Congress eager to remedy alleged state court abuses and class actions would have chosen to discriminate between two kinds of defendants. And later on says, a good interpreter reads text charitably, not lightly ascribing irrationality to its author. I'm wondering if anybody made an argument in the case, or if you think there's any merit to the suggestion that it should have been read the way that the dissent indicates, because it actually poses a constitutional equal protection problem of an irrational distinction if you read it the way Justice Thomas has.
I don't think anybody phrased it in terms of constitutionality, and certainly that wasn't in the question presented, that the statute's unconstitutional because it discriminates against third-party defendants. Rational basis review is a light enough touch that the reasoning, if it's any possible reasoning, well, the possible reasoning is we wanted some additional federal jurisdiction, but we didn't want to have too much additional federal jurisdiction. And so it's not even clear that rational basis review would get you anywhere.
I certainly concede that. I only meant to suggest that the dissent was very strong in the sort of type of language they used to describe the distinction as being effectively irrational.
I certainly find the dissent persuasive. It's not often that I disagree with Justice Thomas, but I think here Justice Alito has the stronger of it. But, It's a 5-4 decision, so those are often, especially in statutory interpretation, those are often going to be close cases. But, maybe that's something a future Home Depot can attempt to raise, that, what's the remedy then? Is the remedy, well, we're striking 1453 entirely? It's not that, though the court has done it from time to time, but the court generally does not avail itself of the power to rewrite a statute to correct a constitutional infirmity like that. So,
yeah, and I think the ship has sailed on that, probably because the interpretation has come down. I meant it more from a constitutional avoidance doctrine even to suggest that it ought to be read Alito's way, but now that the decision is here, I certainly wouldn't want to strike down CAFA.
All of that is true. I don't recall the briefs off the top of my head. I don't think anybody raised a canon of constitutional avoidance. It's not even clear that it would create a constitutional problem to do that. It's arbitrary, certainly, but, it's no more arbitrary than the distinction between a $5 million class action and a $4 million class action. And one gets federal jurisdiction and one doesn't.
Very good. Thank you so much for your question. We do appreciate the back and forth. Seeing no immediate questions from the audience, Ted, I turn the mic back to you. You're welcome to expound further on anything you've talked already, jump into the URI decision, or just give us your closing thoughts today. What would you like to do?
I'm not sure that we have the time on the call to go into a lengthy discussion of Erie, but Erie Railroad versus Tompkins did sort of change the dynamic between federal and state law when it removed the federal common law. Before Erie, if you sued an out-of-state defendant, you had a choice. You could sue the out-of-state defendant in their home state and prevent removal and subject yourself to the out-of-state defendant's state law, or you could sue in your home state, and if your home state had unfavorable law, the defendants could remove to federal court and take advantage of federal common law as a default. And because of that, states had no incentive to structure their law to favor plaintiffs or defendants. If they structured their law too heavily to favor plaintiffs, it would prejudice in-state defendants, and in-state plaintiffs couldn't take advantage of it because any suits they brought would be removed to federal court and subjected to federal common law. When Erie got rid of the federal common law, and Michael Greva has written very wisely about this, it has now changed the incentives of the way state courts to structure their laws. Now state courts have the incentive to make their laws as plaintiff-friendly as possible because it's out-of-state defendants who bear the costs of any expansion of the law to favor plaintiffs at the expense of defendants. And it's in-state plaintiffs who will benefit. And therefore, just simply as a matter of public choice, you'd rather favor your in-state plaintiffs rather than the out-of-state defendants. And there's sort of a race to the bottom to create plaintiff-friendly state court jurisdiction. One has sympathy for Thomas's respect for state courts, and it certainly makes sense under the original understanding of the Constitution. But because Erie Railroad has destroyed the federal common law, that has sort of disrupted the original structure of the Constitution and the relationship in the federal state courts, and creates sort of a need for federal jurisdiction to avoid the problems identified by Alexander Hamilton Federalist number 80 that didn't exist before, where diversity jurisdiction could protect defendants from prejudicial state laws. In that absence, we have the sort of problems we saw that led to the Class Action Fairness Act and are at risk of seeing again.
Well, thank you, Ted. Everyone, thank you for calling in today. Ted, do you have anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up today?
Yep. Thanks again for having me, and thanks for interesting questions and discussion.
Of course. Well, we found this very enjoyable, and we do appreciate your time. So on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank you for the benefit of your very valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.